Hello, my name is Dave Emery once again. And rather than conclude the series with the chilling description of the actual execution of Ron Goldman and Nicole, thought I'd also fill in some material, the rest of the blow-by-blow account, so to speak, of this particular crime, and the informant's description of how exactly the physical evidence was planted in order to frame O.J. Simpson. Once again, the book Blood Oath by Stephen Worth, W-O-R-T-H, and Carl Jaspers, C-A-R-L-J-A-S-P-E-R-S, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. And this book is distributed by the Lee Salters Company. The 800 number that people can call in order to order the book is 800-356-9315. That's 800-356-9315. We're going to turn again to the actual minute, more or less minute-by-minute account of the executions and the planting of the evidence. I think in terms of for historical slash curiosity value, the actual story of how the physical evidence was planted, at least according to this informant, codenamed Skinner, might be worth including in the narrative. Also, I'm going to sum up briefly what we've looked at in this series, and give a few thoughts about the book as a whole, assuming we have time. Returning once again to the chapter that presents Skinner's account, it's chapter 15, of how the executions and planting of evidence took place. 2246 hours. Blade, and by the way, each of the team members of this elite Nazi strike team is known by a code name. 2246 hours. Blade radioed that the task was complete and briefly explained his outburst. Quote, "We're wrapping it up now so you can relax, but better start the banging now without the glove. We'll plan it later. Copy?" Blade requested, interrupting the banging as the banging on Cato's on the wall of the guest house to alert Cato. 2246 hours. Quote, "The limo driver just called his mother. Can you believe it? He wants his mama. What a wuss." 2247 hours. Grip responded, "Copy. Will do." 2248 hours. Grip took the pool stick with a plastic bag and cotton wrapped around the broad end of it and performed the cueing, as it was later jokingly called. This concerns the planting of a bloody glove, which was taken from the murder scene to O.J.'s place and stuck to a chain-link fence. 2248 hours. Blade checked Nicole and then Goldman. Thumper undid the intercom bug and recovered the recorder. Blade took off O.J.'s knit cap and dropped it and his left glove just to his left under the overhang of a small shrub. 2249 hours. Blade deliberately walked through the puddle of blood surrounding Nicole, ensuring that the soles of the Bruno Maglis were sufficiently wet to leave a trail. Then he walked up the left side of the walkway toward the back gate. Using the syringe of O.J.'s blood he took from his fanny pack, like a craftsman gluing parts together, he squeezed out a series of blood drops next to the footprints. He placed the drops at strategic positions along the way. Then he carefully walked back towards the front, taking care not to step on the fresh prints by staying to his left. Every now and then, he stopped to survey his work. When he reached the bodies, he let a couple of more drops fall from the syringe. Drippings off the knife provided additional spots. In the alley, Blade and Speedy unsnapped their jumpsuits and placed them along with Blade's shoes, what was left of Speedy's shoe coverings, socks, gloves, and knives in a plastic garbage bag. Blade kept his O.J. mask on. By the way, interjecting, of course, the conspirators had, according to this account, acquired a sample of O.J.'s blood from one of their Nazi-slash-white supremacist cohorts who was a blood and DNA, was described as a blood and DNA specialist at Cedars-Sinai Hospital when O.J. was having some surgery there. That individual was codenamed Colby. It might be Stephen Garrett Colburn, an acquaintance of Timothy McVeigh's, and an apparent white supremacist who may have been one of the weapon suppliers for the AME church operation. But again, that is conjectural. 2249, that's one of the elements of conjecture that the authors engage in. 2249 hours. Driver just made another call. No answer. 2250 hours. Blade and Speedy, dressed in their cooler dark short-sleeve shirts and jeans, pulled out in the OJ look-alike Bronco, leaving Thumper and the Enforcer to gather up the folding ladder plus any other remaining marks of their visit, thus putting the finishing touches on the frame of the century, unquote. Curious about the identity of Nicole's visitor, the Enforcer entered the condo. After a quick walkthrough, he noticed a cup of ice cream he had watched Nicole buy at Ben and Jerry's sitting on the back downstairs banister. He had always wanted to try that chocolate ice cream with the chunks. However, this cup could only remind him of the visitor. "Shame you couldn't stay around and enjoy the dessert," he remarked to the cup. Outside, Murphy's Law provided an incident that almost destroyed our carefully orchestrated plan. 2251 hours. Blade left Bundy with his lights off and almost ran into a gray Nissan. He yelled obscenities at the driver. "Effin' Jap cars," unquote, while he attempted to cross San Vicente after running a red light. That cardinal sin, which had been discussed many times, was almost the downfall of the plan. Speedy spotted the confrontation coming and ducked down out of sight. Looking back on it, whoever the other drivers were, all they saw was O.J. Simpson in a white Ford Bronco with his license plate heading towards Rockingham. By the way, that was a woman named Jill Shively. And when the timeline of her running into O.J. did not jibe with the official already decided upon version of what had happened, she chose to disregard that. I believe Jill Shively also had sold her story to the National Enquirer as well, and so would not have been eligible as a witness. Continuing, 2252 hours. Now the driver's answering the car phone, getting some instructions from someone. Must be his boss, unquote. 2253 hours. Now, O.J.'s telephones were turned back on. Recall that this team had not only bugged O.J.'s and Nicole's phones, but had disabled O.J.'s phone so he couldn't either receive or place any phone calls to give him an alibi. They had also put bugs in both O.J.'s and Nicole's place and had the places under physical surveillance. Again, many of these people were veteran covert ops veterans, ex-Green Beret, law enforcement, and others with, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, as my eight-part series put it. And they had the most sophisticated surveillance and intelligence equipment available. This basically was a covert operation, albeit one at least ostensibly pulled out, at least at the operational level, by this white supremacist group, this Nazi group. It would not surprise me, again, that if their command structure could be followed all the way up, something they, of course, could not do. They were in a blind cell, that one might very well find elements within our own government that were in cahoots with these this team. Again, the government, there's no such thing as the government. There are all sorts of disparate elements of the government, many of which don't get along with or actually oppose the actions of other elements. So it's important, I think, not to conceive of the government as a single entity. There are many, many, many different elements in it, many of them opposed to each other. Continuing, 2254 hours. Grip spotted O.J. coming out of the house with some bags, followed by his dog. He dropped the bags outside, walked around a little, and suddenly, seemingly mindful of the time, rushed back in. The limo driver may have spotted him. 2255 hours. The limo driver tried the intercom again. He heard, we heard, and recorded O.J. answering. 2256 hours. Grip reported Cato opened the gate from inside by pushing a remote electric switch. 2257 hours. Blade parked their Bronco on Bristol and waited for O.J. and the limo to leave for the airport. 2300 hours. Grip observed O.J. coming outside to greet the limo driver. The light overhead reflected off O.J.'s hair, which appeared wet as if he had just showered, and it had not been dried. 2305 hours. It appeared that our banging piqued O.J.'s and Cato's interest. Thanks to the listening devices we planted in the fortress, we heard them discussing the noise behind Cato's room and where to look for a flashlight. 2315 hours. O.J. and the limo finally departed for the airport, turning left past and around the Bronco. 23:16 hours. By now, the enforcer had cleaned up the planted bugs and remotes inside the condo. Thumper had climbed the pole in the back alley and removed the tap. They had one more task, yet they had to wait another half hour to perform it until they were sure O.J. would make his flight. I remember the newspaper article which said he's always running late. 23:45 hours. Grip spotted Cato leaving his room. He's walking up towards the front door. What's he doing now? Cato just went inside. I wonder, unquote. Grip interrupted his rambling statement, again quoting, he's coming back out and heading back toward his room, unquote. 23:46 hours. While the enforcer kept a watchful eye on the surrounding area, now awake due to Nicole's howling dog, Thumper approached 874 Bundy across the street. He created a minor disturbance at the house. From our previous surveillance, we knew an elderly woman lived there and any noise would result in a call to the local police department. The murders had to be discovered early so our Trojan horse could perform. That is some of their Nazi and white supremacist cohorts inside of L.A. law enforcement. But since this was a blind cell, they did not know the actual identities of who they were. Continuing. On his way back across the street, Thumper's final act was to further open Nicole's front gate so the bodies could be seen when the police arrived. 23:59 hours. Blade removed the interior light bulb of O.J.'s Bronco. He and Speedy wiped blood from their gloves around the interior. They paid particular attention to the center console, then tried to leave a bloody footprint on the carpet. Being only partially successful, the gloves were placed back in the plastic bag of bloody clothes, and O.J.'s plates were reattached. The Bronco was then moved back to its original position, just north of the 360 curb marking. To enter the fortress, by the way, again, the term fortress here is a nickname they had applied to O.J.'s residence. To enter the fortress, they scaled the wall by using the limb of a tree protruding over the wall near the Ashford Gate. They walked to the Rockingham driveway. As they walked up the drive toward the house, they squeezed a few drops of O.J.'s blood out of the syringe to continue the trail of blood that previously had ended in the alley behind Nicole's condo. 2400 hours. Grip and I headed into the fortress using the Ashford Gate entrance. We had watched Cato open this gate several times without any key and knew the routine. O.J.'s dog ran toward us and started to make strange dog noises. I hit him with a dart containing a low-level tranquilizer, similar to the type used to transport animals aboard aircraft. Grip, who was carrying the bag of bloody clothes he had removed from our Bronco, tripped on a shrub and blurted out, quote, son of a bitch, unquote. The dog became very quiet. 00:01 hours. Lucky Monday, June 13th. Grip and I went through the paces of removing all traces of our presence from the outside, including bugs and remote devices. We used the security code previously obtained to enter the house and remove all embedded bugs. We were also going to plant in O.J.'s bedroom the bloody socks Blade had worn. Unfortunately, they had sunk into a pool of blood that had collected in the bottom of the plastic garbage bag used to transport them from the scene. They were soaked. Too bloody. We thought they would raise the suspicions of investigators to make such a find of one pair of extremely bloody socks in a pristine bedroom otherwise devoid of such evidence. So we stuffed them back in the bag. Meanwhile, Blade and Speedy retrieved the remaining glove Blade had worn at Bundy from the plastic bag of bloody clothes and took it to the area behind Cato's room and dropped it there. 00:09 hours. We overheard a call to the police about a burglary at 874 Bundy. We knew they'd look around and find the bodies. 00:12 hours. All three vehicles were on the road following their pre-programmed routes out of Los Angeles. I couldn't help but smile as I conjured up the look that this one rich nigger would have on his face when they arrested his sorry A blank blank and piled the evidence we planted on top of him. I'd give anything to get inside of his brain to watch the activity as he tries to generate an alibi. It's going to be extremely interesting when he testifies. Excuse me, I believe the pool cue was actually used to I'm a little confused from reading the account. The pool cue may very well have been used to somehow plant the glove at the actual murder scene, or else there's an editorial mistake here in the account. But in any event, there's discussion of a plan to use a pool cue to plant the glove. However, the description here was of dropping it behind Kato's. Perhaps there was a change in the scenario, or perhaps the pool cue was simply used to transport a glove from the murder scene into the bag so that it basically... it's unclear to me. There's either an editorial mistake or there was a change in plans that is not accounted for in this particular account. Continuing. Meanwhile, Blade and Speedy retrieved the remaining glove Blade had worn at Bundy from the plastic bag of bloody clothes and took it to the area behind Kato's room and dropped it there. Maybe they're simply referring to dropping it there with the pool cue. Anyway, it's unclear here. 0009 hours. We overheard a call to the police about a burglary at 874 Bundy. We knew they'd look around and find the bodies. 0012 hours. All three vehicles were on the road following their pre-programmed routes out of Los Angeles. I couldn't help but smile as I conjured up the look that this one rich nigger would have on his face when they arrested his sorry A-blank-blank and piled the evidence we planted on top of him. I'd give anything to get inside of his brain and watch the activity as he tried to generate an alibi. It's going to be extremely interesting when he testifies. And by the way, again, forgive my use of strong language. I'm reading the dialogue and text here as it is presented in order to maintain the veracity or the verisimilitude of what is written here. Continuing. 0013 hours. The police arrive at 874 and 875 Bundy Drive. Undoubtedly, this was a record response time for the LAPD, or that Sunday night must have been one hell of a slow night of crime. In either case, the rush to justice that we predicted had begun. Driven by a political need to quench the fires of criticism that engulfed the inept Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, headed by Gil Garcetti, a must-convict mentality reigned. The morning of June 13, 1994, began with a rapid call-up of a grand multitude of investigative and prosecutorial forces. The world would shortly witness one of the greatest marshalings of legal power ever assembled for the sole purpose of proving that O.J. Simpson committed the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman. A plan conceived by the leader of a group many agencies warned was, quote, armed and dangerous, unquote, had accomplished a feat that would be etched in history, forever. The frame was now a reality. And that is the informant's account of how the information, how the evidence was planted. Again, just exactly how the pool cue fits in here remains something of a question in my mind. I'm going to briefly sum up what we've looked at in this particular series. We began by taking a look at some of the previous... Well, first of all, we began by taking a look at the circumstances under which this anonymous informant, codenamed Skinner, who maintains he was a member of this strike team, contacted the authors. Recall that he had not only been feeling guilty about some of the carnage after Oklahoma City, but also some of his Vietnam War nightmares, some of the ferocious nightmares that he'd been having, had begun to return after Oklahoma City and the murders of Ron and Nicole. And he began having these nightmares where he would wake up just bathed in sweat. And a combination of that and apparently some guilt over Oklahoma City and also apparently losing some of his comrades at Oklahoma City led him to decide to communicate this information. We then looked at a couple of past operations, one successful and one abortive, from this same group. One, the successful operation was the murder of music promoter and nightclub owner Brett Cantor. O.J.'s defense team, by the way, in the trial pointed out the similarity in the way that Brett Cantor had been murdered. This white supremacist team, this Nazi team, had approached Brett Cantor about promoting a white supremacist band called Rahowa, R-A-H-O-W-A, or Racial Holy War. He refused to do that and apparently had some unkind remarks about the group. That cost him his life, and they cut his throat in an almost identical fashion to the way Ron's and Nicole's throats were cut. This group was unable to pull off a bombing and slaughter of the parishioners at the AME, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, I believe it was. Anyway, the AME Church in Los Angeles. It may be that one of their associates, they boast of one of their associates having been the weapons supplier for that operation. Then we took a look at the planning for what was a PSYOP, basically, and we're going to touch on this at the end of this broadcast, a psychological operation intended to divide blacks and whites in order to, if not a foment a race war, to promote the eventual rise to power of this Nazi-slash-white supremacist group. We took a look at the fact that this PSYOP was directed at the legal system and also at law enforcement in general and the LAPD in particular. We took a look at the foreign backers of this particular operation. They were backed by what is described as a foreign terrorist group with unlimited funds. The text suggests the distinct possibility that this may have been a German Nazi group of some kind, but that also is not absolutely established. We also took a look at the fact that this strike team was composed of members of blind cells, and that indeed only the ex-former high-ranking military officer known as the Deliverer knew who the, quote, generals, unquote, in the operation were. He also was the go-between between this blind cell and the unnamed foreign terrorist group. We took a look at the successful recruiting by Dennis Mahone, one of the individuals being pursued by Timothy McVeigh's attorney, Stephen Jones. Dennis Mahone recruited the white supremacists, recruited LAPD and LA Sheriff's Office members into his white supremacist group, the White Knights of the Imperial Klan. According to the informant, his efforts were much more successful than the authorities realized, and apparently some of those recruits participated as the, quote, Trojan horse, unquote, including the cop stationed at the station house that would be called to respond to the murders. That cop or cops, it's unclear whether it's more than one, referred to by the code name the Dark German. We took a look at information that indicated that some of these cops had delivered a warning to O.J. that his life was in danger. These cops were not only supplying field-level intelligence about O.J.'s domestic difficulties to the strike team, but they also were intended to lead the investigation in the direction of O.J. Simpson. We also looked at information indicating that, in fact, O.J. Simpson, according to accounts in a Mark Elliott book about Cato Kalin, had been receiving threats from a white supremacist group and that the warnings had been delivered by detectives in LAPD. We looked at the extensive military covert operations and law enforcement backgrounds of the team that accomplished this particular hit, according to Skinner. We took a look at the extremely sophisticated surveillance and monitoring equipment, surveillance and intelligence equipment that this group had, night vision devices. They bugged the phones, they bugged the residences, or they tapped the phones, they bugged the residences. The group also, that is to say this strike team, CAUSE, had assistance from forensics people who told them what they would need in terms of evidence to frame O.J. Simpson. They also, according to the account presented here, had someone who was involved with blood and DNA at Cedars-Sinai Hospital when O.J. was having surgery there. That may very well have been Stephen Garrett Colburn. The authors speculate that that may have been Stephen Garrett Colburn, an acquaintance of McVeigh's who was up on a weapons charge and was wanted for basically, there was a warrant out for his arrest. He was a blood and DNA specialist at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in exactly this time period. We also took a look at the fact that, according to Skinner, the team entered O.J.'s residence and took out clothes and shoes and other possessions of O.J.'s to plant at the scene, that they were also following and bugging Paula Barbieri's place, Paula Barbieri, O.J. Simpson's girlfriend at the time. We took a look at some tangential connections between some of the information presented and Oklahoma City. Again, the informant stated that the Oklahoma City operation was performed by this same group, and in fact that it was his disgust over Oklahoma City that led him, in part, to come forward with this information. We took a look at Mark Furman's retiring to Sandpoint, Idaho, just as Louis Beam, the author of Leaderless Resistance, an Aryan Nations member and member of the Order that had killed Alan Berg, and the 10th anniversary of that killing was to be celebrated with this particular operation, Operation Thunderbolt. We also took a look at possible connections between this cause group and the derailing of the Sunset Limited, an Amtrak train that went down on the second anniversary, October 9th, 1995, of the founding of this group. And we also took a look at Bob Fletcher, a former member of the militia of Montana, and his statement that Mark Furman would make a wonderful recruit for the militias. Finally, we concluded by examining the description, according to Skinner, of the actual execution of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson, and the planting of evidence against O.J. Simpson. I cannot state that there is not disinformation in this book. There may be. I suspect that there was more to this particular operation than we have been seeing. I hold open the possibility that a Nazi faction within our government itself, within the national security establishment, may have been involved with this. I also suspect that corresponding white supremacist and Nazi-oriented elements within the media were part of this same operation. That, however, is pure conjecture on my part. Note again that in addition to exacerbating race relations in this country or hostility between the races, the targets of this operation were the legal system itself and also law enforcement in general and the LAPD in particular. I'm going to reread the description, according to Skinner, of how this operation was planned for. Again, according to the description placed here, or presented here, this was a Nazi psyop, a psychological operation, to occur and to observe the 10th anniversary of Alan Berg's assassination. The plan for the anniversary celebration consisted of a plot so sinister, so creative, so diabolical that the outcome would provide for the embarrassment of an entire city, an entire race, and an entire nation. The plot included a well-thought-out action that would damage the U.S. judicial system forever. It would create a sense of doubt that would exist in every future trial. When we had all gathered in the farmhouse's spacious parlor, the discoverer continued to explain the rationale of the plan. Quote, "Evidence presented and testimony offered by law enforcement officers will be challenged forever from this case forward," unquote, he said. Still quoting, "It's a plan designed in part to be a payback for all those responsible for actions that have been carried out against freedom-loving white supremacists," unquote. Another founder of the cause picked up the explanation. By the way, we also took a look at a legal foundation for white supremacists called Cause, headed up by Kirk Lyons. Continuing, the plan, quote, "The plan is centered around an individual easily recognized and respected among both blacks and whites. It will look like he's being framed by the authorities. The situation's designed to call upon and challenge interpersonal beliefs that every person holds. People will choose sides. Their consciences won't permit otherwise. The final coup will occur when our target is found guilty or his credibility is destroyed. This event will generate instant racial tension, followed by violence. We're going to ensure that by fueling what will already be an inflamed situation. The plan will use the distrust between the authorities and the blacks that's existed in Los Angeles for years. At first, everyone will choose up sides. As the discussions become heated and clouded with rhetoric, violence will follow. After much destruction has occurred, the cause will then step forward to take credit for this framing. But it will be painfully obvious that we couldn't have done it without the help of an easily duped, overzealous prosecution," unquote. Among the questions I have, and that concerns the possibility that perhaps this informant was coming forward in order to perhaps take credit for this operation on behalf of cause. Again, I'm not saying that is the case. However, I don't think that's an unreasonable question to ask under the circumstances. Perhaps the motives for this informant were more complex than we have been told. In any event, that concludes this particular segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.